Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my ever-genial co-host, Eagle One from Eagle Speak. And welcome to another edition for Midrats. For those that are joining us live, if you'd like to, go ahead and scroll down to the bottom of the show page. That's where you'll find the chat room. That's a great place to roll in with your observations and comments as the show goes along. If you have a question you'd like for us to address to our guests where it looks like we might not be heading that direction, that's a great place to put it in, and we'll pull it up into the conversation as the show goes forward. Also, if you have to leave during the course of the show, you can always catch what you missed over at the archive over Blog Talk Radio. And also, if you use iTunes, after our long guerrilla warfare with Apple, we're back up and running on iTunes. You can just go ahead into the podcast section of iTunes and subscribe, and you'll be off and running to listen at your leisure. Now, let's get on with the show. The title of the show, The Long War Update, I think kind of demonstrates exactly what we're going to spend the hour talking, and we have exactly the right returning guest to come back and talk to us. He's been on the show a couple times before, and the last time we had him on the show, it was almost apologetic, trying to remind everybody that what was once called the Long War and had kind of fallen out of favor in usage, it was still there, and lo and behold, we've come back around after a very long spring and summer, and everybody is starting to have that conversation again. So for the full hour today, our guest will be Bill Roggio. He's a senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracy. He's also president of Public Media and Corporate. It's a nonprofit news organization. He's also the founding and editor of the appropriately titled Long War Journal. It's a news site devoted to covering the war on terror. He's embedded with both the U.S. and the Iraqi military six times between 2005 and 2008, and also with the Canadian Army in Afghanistan in 2006. Bill served in the U.S. Army and the New Jersey National Guard from 91 through 97. Bill, welcome back to Midrats.
Oh, pleasure is all mine. It's great to be back with you guys.
Great to have you, Bill. And this is kind of a scene setter. And, as everybody in Afghanistan would be able to relate to the time frame, 2014's fighting season has really changed not just the facts on the ground, but how people are starting to reevaluate where we find ourselves in the West. And I kind of hinted at that, you know, the phrase long war, I still think, is probably the best description of what is actually taking place here. It's nothing that's going to be solved inside of an election cycle or any type of convenient calendar somebody want to use. And one of the things that, you know, you look back 13 years ago, and was a regular part of the conversation, was a discussion of failed states and safe havens. And here we find ourselves between Libya, Syria, Iraq, the top three that come to mind, failed states where Islamic fundamentalism has moved in depth. Why are the failed states so critical to the conflict we find ourselves in, and why do people need to pay attention, not just about the failed states, but the ones that are about to become additional failed states?
Yeah, if I may, let me add a couple of countries to that list, primarily Pakistan, Somalia, Afghanistan, Mali, Nigeria. Shall we continue? I'll leave it at there. Those are the biggies. No less failed than Syria, Iraq. Egypt is heading down that road with its insurgency in the Sinai. Failed states are – before I even turn to that, I want to just talk about the term the long war real quick. You know, it is appropriately aptly named because and I hate to give credit to the Taliban for this, for this statement that's attributed to the Taliban, but it's so right. I mean, you nailed it. We think in terms of election cycles, 2 years and 4 years, and we hope our wars are done there. We're fighting an enemy that's committed. No matter what we think of them, we have to take them seriously, and they are committed to decades and centuries. I mean, that's what they've said, and that is how they act. And the Taliban have that statement, you know, we the West have all the clocks and they have all the time. And that is why we are in a long war. We may have all the weapons and all the fancy, you know, the drones and this and that. But if we're not committed to the fight, if we're not committed to fight the long war, then we cede the battlefield to our enemy. Now, to turn back to the actual question you asked me, failed states, yes, it's extremely important. I'm going to explain why. Prior to 9/11, where did jihadist groups have their training camps? They had some, primarily in Afghanistan, really, and maybe a little bit in Pakistan's tribal areas if you count some Taliban groups and whatnot. But where did al-Qaeda itself have its training? It was in Afghanistan, and they were able to plot and execute multiple attacks against the West, not just 9/11, but U.S. Embassy in Kenya and Nairobi, or Kenyan Tanzania, 98, and other attacks. Where do we have them today? Where do we have training camps for al-Qaeda groups in all these failed states? I left one off the list I gave you. Yemen, training camps there. Syria, training camps. Iraq, training camps. Somalia, Nigeria, Mali. They're all over the place now. So they have a greater pool to recruit for and a greater network to train people. You have Islamist fighters from countries like Benin and Togo and Cameroon. When do we start? And, you know, no matter what people say, people's countries are scrutinized on passports. Where do we start drawing that line? I mean, do we have to start looking for jihadists from the Nigeria? Are we worried about people holding passports from there? Well, we better be, because Boko Haram is an al-Qaeda, not affiliated group, but at least not yet, but an al-Qaeda allied group, and they conduct attacks just like al-Qaeda does. So those training camps are key, and we got to remember, those training camps, al-Qaeda, what is al-Qaeda's primary goals? Or not just al-Qaeda, or jihadists, global jihadists. Their goal is to establish an Islamic state and impose Sharia law. That's what they want to do. That's their stated goal. Administration officials laugh at this and think it's unserious, except we're watching this strategy unfold. They're doing it in all the failed states that we mentioned at the beginning of the show. And so most of their fighters that are going through these camps are used to fight their local insurgencies, which this is something, again, that the administration officials want to say, well, they're not a threat to us because all they care about is local insurgencies. Yeah, because those local insurgencies, to create individual Islamic emirates or viliyats or whatever they call them, basically individual states within the global caliphate, they're working to their ultimate goal. You can't have a global Islamic state without having individual emirates in it. And then, okay, so the fighters that are going through the camps, most of them are fighting the local insurgencies, and they siphon off a small portion of them to conduct external attacks. Prior to 9/11, you know, maybe had 10, 20, whatever the estimate of the number is, I've seen it all over the places, going through al-Qaeda training camps in Afghanistan. Now you have 10 times the amount of countries that have training camps. I don't see this ending well for us without, you know, it's just a matter of time before they get off another major attack. I'm not sure it'll be 9/11, but there's other types of attacks that they can execute, Mumbai-type attacks, those what I call the suicide assault, where a heavily armed assault team fights to the death in major cities. And Mumbai in 2008 was a classic example. They shut down that city for almost 3 days, or at the mall in Nairobi just last year at the Westgate Mall, shut down that area of the city. I mean, it creates terror. That's what they're working towards. That's where those threats of those camps come from, not just for terrorist attacks against us. But also for them to establish their global state, the Islamic Caliphate.
Well, I had, just like the last time I talked to you, which was just a few months ago, I had a big long list of states. You've run through most of them. One of the other things is that Al-Qaeda just announced that they're moving into opening a branch in the Indian subcontinent. I mean, I thought they already had branches in the Indian subcontinent, but is that just a ploy because ISIS or whatever it is getting all the news media, or are they really moving into that area in force?
Unfortunately, I think what we have in the media is we have this sort of binary thinking on jihadist groups. Well, Al-Qaeda, Islamic State, declared a caliphate, and they control half of Iraq and half of Syria. Therefore, Al-Qaeda is weak, and they're no longer relevant. You know, Al-Qaeda can also be relevant while the Islamic State is as well. The reality is what happened in the Indian subcontinent is basically what I documented for the last 8 years and what got the Longhorn Journal website banned in Pakistan, which is that Al-Qaeda's working with these local jihadist groups, supported by the Pakistani state or elements within it. We knew, so for instance, we should have known that there was an affiliate in the Indian subcontinent. All they did was package up all the people they've been working with, all of these various groups, and declare their regional affiliate. It's that simple, but we should have seen this coming. We killed Elias Kashmiri. He was the head of a group called the Harkat ul Jihadi Islami. He wasn't just that. It's a Pakistani terrorist group. But he wasn't just the head of that. He was also on Al-Qaeda's military council and commanded by what's known as the Shadow Army or the Lashkar-e-Zil. This is a group that's basically Al-Qaeda's paramilitary army in Afghanistan and Pakistan. We killed Bader Mansour, who was a senior leader in Harkat ul Mujahideen. He commanded, and this is in the Bin Laden documents, one of Al-Qaeda's companies, right? Not just one, but multiple military companies, which he commanded about 2,000 fighters. Bin Laden mentions him directly. And what is, but Harkat ul Mujahideen is a Pakistani terrorist group, or is it? So we... It's someone like me who's following this in detail, it really comes as no surprise. Unfortunately, the media's read on this, it's a simplistic analysis that, again, I think it really just reflects a lack of understanding of what's been happening in Southeast Asia or South Asia for the last decade.
Part of the problem with the media, and I've been trying to get my head around it as well, part of me thinks it's laziness, but more and more I'm beginning to think that it's a knee-jerk institutional inability to think along what our enemy is thinking of, religious terms. The balance of the 20th century was spent fighting ism, communism, fascism. But we do have another ism that's creating transnational conflict and is threatening the world order. It's just Islamism, which is associated with a religion. In order to address a problem, you have to be able to talk about it clearly. Is that also part of the problem? Is it institutional, media, and call it whatever you want to, ability to think about this in terms the enemy does, where it is another ism, but it's a religious base?
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. It is both media and political figures. Religion's icky. We refuse to recognize that these jihadists are part of an Islamist movement or Islamism. They refuse to recognize, or they don't take it seriously. They just say, "Oh, well, they're just a bunch of kooks, or they're just power hungry, or they are that." But they also have a plan, and they're acting out on their plan. I'm going to turn back to the media coverage of the Islamic State. While they get great details on this group, but the overall analysis that I see coming out, it's stunningly bad, because they're just, again, they have to have a singular enemy, or they have to have one group that could be ascendant, and it can't be multiple. You can't have two jihadist groups. Just because the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda are at odds with each other doesn't mean that both of them can't be powerful organizations. And by the way, what happens to the Islamic State if we do indeed decapitate the leadership? Does that cause a rapprochement to these two groups? Nobody's even asking these questions. Because they're really, the dispute is a leadership dispute between the two groups. But, yeah, to answer your question, I couldn't agree with you more. I think part of this, it's simple analysis. It's easy to do. It's lazy. And you also have people that are just not looking at this over long periods of time and coming to the right conclusions.
Our Turkish correspondent asked a pretty good question, which is, what happened, this is kind of ground zero, but what happened to Syria and Iraq to turn them into failed states? We can always look back with 20/20 hindsight, but what could the U.S. and its allies have done to prevent what happened and what is happening in those states now?
The reason they became failed states because there's a lot of reasons, and we're going to look at Iraq and Syria here specifically. The Arab Spring opened up, you know, everyone said, remember how many times we were told the Arab Spring is the death knell of Islamist groups, that it's the end of them, end of Al-Qaeda. But look at where they're operating now. Look at Libya today. That gave them a foothold, because these are some of the best fighters in the Muslim world. I mean, look what they've done in Iraq and Syria. They've gone up against professional militaries who, regardless of what you and I think of them, you know, they're well-armed, and they have training, and these militaries have kept rule in these countries for decades. The Assad family has ruled Syria with an iron fist for decades and decades, father and son. Saddam Hussein ruled Iraq for decades as well. So the Arab Spring, it allowed the jihadist groups to come in and say, look, we're the saviors. We can defeat these groups. All the major victories against the Iraqi militaries or the Syrian militaries came from jihadist groups. And so this is a major reason. The other reason, and I'll be accused of being political for this, but if you want, we can have a show on how George Bush did tons of things wrong. But the Obama administration's withdrawal from Iraq was so poorly timed, and it was so obvious at the time, just as the Syrian revolution is beginning in 2011, the U.S. wants out of Iraq. And it always viewed Iraq as the Islamic State in Iraq and Al-Qaeda in Iraq and whatever the name of the group was at the time, which was the Islamic State of Iraq. It viewed it as only being based in Iraq, but the reality is it was based in both areas, in both countries. And as a matter of fact, we know this because U.S. Special Operations Forces killed a guy named Abu Ghadi in 2008 in a cross-border raid into Syria. He was the head of the Islamic State of Iraq's network inside of Syria. So when the Syrian civil war started, the tail, the Syrian arm of this, which was the support arm or the tail, it turned into the teeth against the Syrian military. So you had, they were regenerating, they became an outward military movement on the Syrian side of the border. The U.S. leaves Iraq, and there's no one to serve as the adult in the room between Sunni and Shia and Kurds. So you have Sunnis losing power and losing the ability to police areas under their control. Al-Qaeda in Iraq is resurgent there. And look, what are we doing today in Iraq? We're conducting airstrikes. What if we had kept enough forces in Iraq to prevent the Islamic State from taking over vast cities and towns in Iraq? I mean, if we had reacted in Anbar when the Islamic State took over Fallujah in January, do we think that maybe they might not have gone on the offensive in northern and central Iraq in June? I mean, we've kept a hands-off approach because the Obama administration, and he's been clear about them, he's been clear that the war in Iraq and the war in Afghanistan are coming to an end. Well, no, it was the U.S. involvement in these wars that came to an end, not those, the war, but the war's never ended, and jihadist groups, which, again, take a long view, they took a real beating during the surge in 2007, 2008, and 2009, But they regenerated, and they had nothing to oppose them. We couldn't, unable to provide what the Iraqi military needed to prevent the resurgence of al-Qaeda in Iraq or Islamic State of Iraq, which would have been logistical support, helping keep the government together to serve as an honest broker, which all parties viewed the United States, and we would have had air power in country, intelligence, and partnering up with special operations forces. When we pulled those assets in December 2011, it started going downhill real quick. And we got to remember, their plan for the Iraqi military wasn't, oh, well, the U.S. pulls out in 2011 and all is well, they could stand up on their own. General Petraeus' plan was for the Iraqi military to be partnered with and supported directly by the U.S. up until 2020. But that plan was just, the rug was pulled out from that because President Obama wanted out of Iraq, and we have what we have today.
You know,
and as far as, you did ask me about what positives do I see with U.S. interactions in Iraq and Syria, and the answer to that is none.
Well, that is the executive summary, and I think you're spot on there, Bill. And I think it may actually have been on one of the, I think maybe the first time we had you on, and I think the time is now. But I've said a few times over the years that somewhere there's a young PhD candidate who's going to do their dissertation and is going to write a book about what's happening here online with McMaster's dereliction of duty.
Yes.
And bright shining lie about the very obvious and the clear mistakes that we're just now starting to see, the first iteration of, and hopefully that young man or woman is already doing their research, because I think there's a lot of very good scholarship that can be done about what you were just describing there. And one thing that I think is different, and people warned about this, this isn't new. The old, on the back of the Prius, the think locally, act globally, and what we're seeing in the Islamic State is exactly that, is this is not an indigenous operation. Lots of foreign fighters holding passports, not just from some of the failed states, but from the UK, Denmark, Norway, the Netherlands, the United States, Canada. Those passports are extremely powerful. One would hope that the Western intelligence agencies are building up their naughty and nice list as we speak. That type of training ground for international fighters, who do you see either in the public sphere or a writer in security matters is thinking clearly about the implications of these hundreds to thousands of hardened Islamists walking around with American and British passports, and what implication that's going to have on our security, on our borders? Or are we just going to have to wait for another horrible act before there's the political courage to do what needs to be done?
I think we're going to have to wait for another horrible act. I don't see any serious scholarship being done on this issue or any serious concern from public officials or military intelligence or within think tanks. People are still asking the question, where did the Islamic State come from? Well, the answer was they used to be, where did they get their skills? Because we fought them from 2004 on. They're the same group. It's al-Qaeda in Iraq. So when I see those questions coming up from people that are supposed to be serious, or when I see Admiral Kirby, Rear Admiral Kirby, the spokesman for the Pentagon, saying, defending President Obama, indefensible JV comment. Remember when he said that the Islamic State, he said this in January, as the Islamic State took over Fallujah, that they're the JV team, and just because you put a Lakers uniform on a JV team, it doesn't make them Kobe Bryant, until they are Kobe Bryant, right? I mean, do they develop this type of capacity in just 8 months? Is that what Admiral Kirby we're supposed to believe? I mean, and he's a serious. If this is the type of thinking that exists in our military and intelligence, maybe he's just making a political defense. But you know what? I have to take him at his word. And if this is the type, and by the way, I'm told that this is the type of thinking that exists in higher echelons of the military intelligence and political leadership. So I'm just not seeing it. I am people still don't get what's happening, and they still refuse to recognize what's happening in front of them. And it's a direct result of failed policies for the last, well, since 9/11. Again, we've refused to define, we can't even define what the enemy is. And until we define the nature of the enemy, and I haven't seen anyone seriously attempt to do that. Tom Joslin and I, we attempt to do this at the Long War Journal and in conversations, but no one's really talking about this in a manner that needs to be done. We're a voice in the wilderness. We're the minority report.
I think it's John Rosenberg who I first noticed pointing out that in Syria the black flag of Al-Qaeda was flying among some of the I'm sure you were on it too, but the black flag of Al-Qaeda was part of the movement to get rid of Assad. At least there somewhere in the crowd. Speaking of which, now Libya is undergoing some kind of mess. We've got Nigeria, Boko Haram, doing their seizing territory. Can you talk a little bit? Let's talk a little bit about North Africa, the northern part of Africa, where this is new caliphate, Boko Haram, and some of these other folks are pushing. How big a threat do you perceive that to be for us?
Okay, so Boko Haram, and actually the Shekau, the head of Boko Haram, he didn't actually declare a caliphate. What he said was he creating an Islamic state or an emirate, basically. That would be part of the caliphate. Again, the media completely took his statements out of context and got that wrong. And they said, see, look, they're emulating, they emulate the Islamic State. They want to be just like the Islamic State. Well, the answer is no. They're doing exactly what Al-Qaeda's always been attempting to do, which is, create individual emirates or states that'll be part of the global caliphate. As far as the threat that the group poses, U.S. directly, I mean, the answer to this is how do you perceive the threat to be? Is the threat that do you take serious the threat of a global caliphate? If you do, then what Boko Haram is doing is extremely dangerous. I mean, anytime the enemy gains territory and establishes training camps, it's a direct threat to the United States. I take it extremely seriously. They're radicalizing large numbers of people. They're in control of large areas in northern Nigeria now. This is a group that in 2011 attacked the United Nations headquarters in the capital of Nigeria. So they've, and they've also been training, cross-training with jihadist groups throughout various areas. They fought in Mali. They've trained Somali fighters and accepted training from Shabab, which is Al-Qaeda's affiliate in Somalia and East Africa. I view all of these groups, any group that is out there and is, I don't look at this as, well, this group, it's distinct from this group, it's distinct. They all share the same goals. They're all part. Like, this would be like saying, well, do we view the Italians any less of a threat during World War II than the Germans or the Japanese or the, I mean, they're all our enemy. And they were all fighting for the same goal, the defeat of the United States and Britain and Russia. So we have to take them all seriously. And our failure to do so gives them room to thrive. And they are thriving. They're thriving in these failed states. I mean, the Nigerian government and military has lost control of large areas of northern Nigeria, and it's fanning out into other countries. It's into Mali, into Cameroon, into Niger. You had all kinds of attacks being launched from Nigeria or from Mali or from Libya from these areas. And did you ask about Libya as well?
Yeah, I did ask about Libya.
Yeah, and it's a different dynamic. And by the way, this is – remember we were told – I get a question. Whatever happened to the Pottery Barn theory of warfare? Colin Powell's, you break it, you bought it.
Yeah,
right?
Where is
Colin? Wasn't that the golden rule? Don't get involved unless – and yet what did we do in Libya? We ousted Gaddafi because he had to go because he turned over his chemical weapons and was jailing Islamists. So he had to go because it was fashionable, because we were – and here's another thing. This use of humanitarian intervention for as a cover for U.S. military action. We're doing it in Iraq today. I find it extremely repugnant. If a group is a threat, then a group is a threat. Call them as such. I don't think the American public is so shallow as to believe that, oh, well, we're doing this for humanitarian reasons. I'm sorry if I'm going off track here, but, you know, Libya, we greatly contributed to the defeat of Gaddafi, and then we greatly contributed to the rise of the militias because we did nothing afterwards because we had no plan. It was step one, overthrow Gaddafi, and step three, democratic state in Libya. And, you know, whatever happened to step two? There was no step two. And now you have Islamist groups. I mean, we all know what happened in Benghazi. I mean, we just saw video of this Libyan Dawn is an amalgamation of the various Islamic brigades that are fighting in Benghazi and other places. We have them swimming at the embassy complex in Tripoli, killing our ambassador, and, you know, but we shouldn't be worried about any of that. And meanwhile, Libya, I mean, there's vast areas, particularly in southern Libya and eastern Libya, that are out of control of the state and where al-Qaeda is running training camps. It's an absolute mess. This is what happens when you disengage, you know. Maybe it would have been better if we kept Gaddafi in power. No one stopped to think about that because we had to show that we cared about Muslims overthrowing their governments, that we were the guarantor of the Arab Spring until we couldn't because then when it happened against Assad, who's killed far, 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 far more of his countrymen than Gaddafi ever did, and then it wasn't a good idea to conduct airstrikes for humanitarian reasons.
Yeah, you mentioned my co-host mentioned the Potter Barn rule. I used to be in the past tense, I used to be a huge fan of an acolyte and follower of Colin Powell, but he trotted himself out, not trying to be political here, but he started it, so I'll bring it up. He trotted himself out before the 08 election and trotted himself right out again before the 2012 election and to endorse the present administration for whatever reason. But anybody that's read Colin Powell's life work, military strategy, you don't see much of it here. So I wish he had actually done what he said he was going to do and has tried to be some advisor on the side, but I sure as heck don't see it. And that'll mean get off my soapbox here for a second.
No, understood.
You had a touchy spot for me. We could use Colin Powell circa 1998, but he's doing something else.
He could have served as a big critic, you know, and gotten them into, but you know what? His theory isn't being used, and he backed the administration, and so he'll just let that one go. But, you know, I just find that, you know, I'd love to see someone write the paper, whatever happened to the Pottery Barn theory of intervention, because we ain't practicing it, and yet there is no criticism for it. As a matter of fact, what we have now is we're fighting the Israeli way of war, right? Let's use airstrikes. Except how well has that worked in Gaza? Who controls the Israelis left with Gaza in, 2004, 2006? Well, it's 8 to 10 years later. I think it was 2006, but I could be wrong. Hamas still controls Gaza. The Israelis are still fighting wars against Hamas. And they may kill top Hamas leaders and whatnot in airstrikes, but Hamas is still there. And guess what? We think we could do the same thing in Libya and Afghanistan and Pakistan and now in Iraq. And, well, I'd say good luck with that. Someone should ask the Israelis how that's working for them.
Yeah, the whole decapitation theory of warfare, we've tried it multiple times. That theory doesn't quite work out well in practice as it does in academia. Caught on a couple things here, and I'm very curious when we're going to reach this point, especially the United States, which became a nation that was cut out of another via revolution and war. So we're on pretty thin ice telling other people they can't do it. But, you know, people like to talk about ISIS, which I still grin about being a Gen X person. That was a cartoon that we watched on Sunday morning.
Right.
It was an Egyptian love. Then we went to ISIL. But really, it is what they say it is. It's an Islamic state They've carved out a bit of territory. Its borders are quasi-undefined at this point. But eventually we're going to reach the point. Assad's not going to push them out. The Iraqi Shias aren't going to push them out. The Kurds aren't going to go very much further from their highlands. They're going to have a state, and at some point somebody is going to recognize it. How long do you think it might take before it becomes just a fax on the ground, hey, this is not just a bunch of terrorists taking territory, this is actually a defined state? And does that change the calculus any on how the regional actors may or may not play in trying to mitigate their growth and impact?
Yeah, it's a great question, and you're right. I mean, the longer they exist as a state, and you're absolutely right. I mean, look, the Iraqi forces, the Kurds, they could chip away at the edges, and they may take towns here, and they have, right? They retook the Mosul Dam, and they retook them really. By the way, I'm not going to go off on too much of a tangent here, but in our air support of Iraqi operations in Mreli, we supported a group called Isib al-Haq, and nobody knows who they are, but I do. This is a group that is supported by Iran. It's called the League of the Righteous. It's the ones that conducted most of those EFP attacks in Baghdad and southern areas that killed hundreds of Iraqi or American troops. It's the same group that kidnapped and executed five Americans in Karbala at the joint center in Karbala. It was 2007. Three of their leaders are specially designated global terrorists. We acted as their air arm because this militia, which was founded by Hezbollah in Iran, it was the primary infantry in taking the town of Imreli. They can chip away at the edges, but I think you're right. I mean, until there's a serious, who's the only one that can do what needs to be done? It'd be U.S. is the only. Am I advocating this? I'm not saying that it's a great. I don't know the answer right now. I haven't formulated the answer myself. But to me, if the group is evil, as John Kerry said, or Secretary Kerry said, and it's cancer, as President Obama said, or the greatest threat to the West, as Chuck Hagel said, and or whatnot, well, then you kind of have to do something about that. And you can't just rely on coalitions and, you know, some airstrikes and hoping that things come together. It's eventually somebody has to get in there, and I don't see that, because we're not going to see Obama walk back his no boots on the ground in Iraq. Or maybe he does. But until that time comes, they are going to be an Islamic state. And you're right. I think eventually, like the Taliban in Afghanistan, now they only had three countries recognize them, but I believe it was Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and Pakistan. Boy, how's that for, by the way, you know, three state sponsors of terrorism or look the other way or whatever you want to call them, no friends of ours. I mean, I think it could be a matter of time before a state like Qatar says, you know what, we have to recognize the facts on the ground, or neighboring countries do. I'd say they're all mad if they do, because, you know, they're going to be coming for them next at some point. How long would that take? It would probably take a couple of years for that to happen. I'm not certain when. I'd have to go back and look it up, but how long it took for the Afghan Taliban to be recognized as the legitimate government, at least by three states. But I'm guessing it wasn't, you know, in 1994, 95 when the Taliban was just starting, but when they really consolidated their control and took the capital and pressed the Northern Alliance into a small sort of pocket within northern Afghanistan.
Somehow during this conversation, I keep getting reminded of that South Park episode with the underwear gnomes, where they...
That's exactly what I was referring to with step one and step three.
It's good.
I have to be somewhat serious, right?
I'm glad I got the reference, but...
I'm glad you did, too.
I'm glad you shared it with
your audience, because I'm a big fan.
what would it take to get the biggest dog in the neighborhood, Turkey, to get involved in this and get them to could they be part of a coalition or a leading force in the coalition to sweep down into Syrian territory and then part of Iraq and help clean up this mess? And would they? What would it take to have them take part?
I think Turkey is somewhat part of the problem. They allowed a lot of these groups to operate from their territory, and they look the other way, even with groups like the Nusra Front and the Islamic State. Look, this is a country that had enormous problems dealing with the PKK on its own territory. You know, is the Turkish military an expeditionary military that could support operations outside its borders for an extended period of time? I have questions about that. This is a country, by the way, that prior to the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, I mean, Saddam Hussein was an enemy, and yet they still couldn't bring themselves to allow a U.S. division to deploy from Turkey. So I just can't, bar a change in government, and well, if the same government's in place, I don't see anything that, you know, maybe massive terrorist attacks by the Islamic State. But, you know, you got to remember, too, if they were going to come down into Syria and take out the Islamist groups, well, then all they're going to do is strengthen Assad. And I don't think that's something they want to do. Or if they do it in northern Iraq, you know, what do the Kurds think of that? So does that cause problems? I can't see them making that sort of commitment. In a perfect world, all of these countries would be, you know, losing their minds over what happens and coming together and making a coalition to do so. And by the way, this is what President Obama is trying to do. I don't think he's going to be very successful in doing so. He'll get a lot of lip service, but at the end of the day, the only one that has the capacity and should have the will to get involved would be the U.S. The Turks aren't going to do it. I don't see, you know, the Egyptians are fighting their own insurgency. The Saudis can't operate in support of an Iranian-backed Shia regime in Iraq. The Jordanians are too weak and are dealing with millions of refugees from Syria already and just don't have the capacity to deal with it. And Europe is Europe, so.
And you outlined exactly why I asked the previous question that I did about, you know, when does it just become a fact from the ground? You know, I've told a couple of people that, hey, you know, if you're missing Game of Thrones and you're waiting for the next season to come on, just pay attention to what's going on around the Islamic
yep.
State right now and who's friends with who and who's not. It's about as complicated as it needs a big whiteboard to explain, because when you look at, you know, who actually is willing to put some blood on the line to push back against the Islamic State in the region, and if we were looking for serious partners besides a village here, a village there, we would have to decide to get cozy and friendly with Assad and Iran. Put that in your drink and stir it around for a bit, because
yep.
you look at the Sunni powers in the area. Turkey, as you outlined perfectly, is an ongoing disappointment, you know. And they do a lot of things that perhaps aren't the friendliest in the world. Perfect example, in Kabul. You wanted to leave the headquarters. You're in an armored vehicle. You're in a convoy, et cetera, and so forth. The Turks would just get in an SUV, put a Turkish flag in either window, and they'd do whatever they want to. Nobody ever bothered them.
Yep.
But the Jordanians, they're already seeing problems on their borders. The Saudis, who it would really be interesting to see what's happening behind closed doors with them, because they've always, we are the Wahhabists, we're the conservative Sunnis, we're the keeper of the two holy cities, et cetera, and so forth. You would think if anybody was motivated to push back on them, the Saudis would, but they're not. Will this ever reach the point that we feel like we just need to partner with Assad and Iran and we'll worry about the implications of the hypocrisy later?
If we want a true Sunni civil war and we want to watch Saudi Arabia and other Sunni countries throw in with jihadist groups, then that would be the ideal thing for us to do. Because one of the things that were part of the discontent within Sunnis within Iraq is that they believe that Maliki is a stooge for the Shia-led government. You know, Maliki's on his way out the door, I think. And they believe that he's backed by Iran. And if the U.S. weighs in on that side, then, yeah, it would be game over for Iraq if we decide. I mean, you would have a temporary win, but then the groups like al-Qaeda and the Islamic State, I mean, keep in mind, in Syria, it's not just the Islamic State isn't the only jihadist group. It's the al-Nusra Front, which is al-Qaeda's branch. They control territory. There's a group called the Mujahideen Army, and they're a bunch of there's Syrians and other foreign fighters, and they're led by a group of very able Chechens. And then there's the Islamic Front, which is a primarily Syrian, but it has foreign fighters. So, yeah, it is Game of Thrones-esque. And if anyone listening to the show isn't watching Game of Thrones or doesn't have HBO, get it. It helps you really understand the complexities of what we're dealing with. And that even just scratches the surface. I think ultimately siding with Assad and siding with Iran to put this, it may seem like a good idea. It may seem like a temporary solution, but it will just make it worse. This was what makes the U.S. withdrawal from Iraq all the worse, because what it did was, and keep in mind, Maliki in 2008 and 2009, he went to war against the Shia-backed groups. He went to war against the Sebel Haq, the Mahdi Army, Hezbollah Gray brigades and whatnot. He actually launched operations in Basra without U.S. support or without informing the Americans and got a bloody nose doing it, but then recovered. And then for about a year and a half, 2 years, just pursued these groups until they all the leaders just retreated into Iran. So Maliki wasn't a reflexive Iranian stooge. It's just that once the U.S. left, who does he turn to for external support? He's a Shia. Does he turn to the Saudis? Does he turn to the Jordanians? Does he turn to the Turks? None of them like them. None of them trust him. He's a Shia, and he's perceived as being part of Iran. So he does turn to Iran. We actually facilitated his push towards more Iranian support. I'm not going to defend the guy. He's done things that have greatly contributed to this situation. But again, without the U.S. being an honest broker there, the U.S. alleviated a lot of these problems that of perceived, Iranian involvement or problems. The Shia thinking that the Saudis are backing Al Qaeda and this and that. A lot of those problems went away in with U.S. presence and without it. It just everyone went to their worst tendencies, and we lost control of the situation. And now, I just can't get over the irony of us conducting airstrikes in Iraq to try and roll back the Islamic State, when if we had just been there, if we had just made a commitment, it never had to get this far.
I'm going to commend some people to read the front part of the Long War Journal is on your webpage. There's a threat matrix, and there's a really good piece in there by Lisa Lundquist on the Islamic State's global reach. And if you take that, it points out all the efforts that the Islamic State has made around the world, including people in Canada and the United States. And we need to talk about that a little bit. I think it's important to understand. I mean, right now it looks like people keep pointing to a hotbed of ISIS people in Minneapolis for some reason. How bad is our problem? How bad is the situation where we're getting people are joining up to join ISIS? And will they? I think you've already said you think they'll come back, but how bad is the situation?
I think it's bad. I mean, it's estimated that thousands of Europeans are currently fighting with the Islamic State or have died fighting with them. And hundreds of Americans, and I think the number for the Canadians was somewhere at 50 or 80. So it's enough. I mean, in Syria, you had an American serve as a suicide bomber. Now, he did it for the al-Nusra Front, which is al-Qaeda's branch. Remember, the Nusra Front and Islamic State are having a leadership dispute over who controls the jihad there and the global jihad. But again, at the end of the day, they're all Islamists and they hate us. But and outside of Somalia, he was the first American suicide bomber outside of Somalia, which there's been at least three Americans who conducted suicide attacks, and they've done it with Shabab, which is Al Qaeda's affiliate there. We should be terrified because the scope of the fighting and the number of camps that have gone up there, are it's just enormous. I mean, they're advertising that they're running training camps. We have to take that seriously. And guess what? These guys are fighting really well. Are they American infantry or American Special Operations Forces or U.S. Marines? No, they're not. But they're certainly good enough to beat the competition that's in front of them. I've always said this, by the way, in Afghanistan and in Iraq. You know, people were like, well, you know, when they fought us, they fought against the varsity, right? They fought against us, the best team, because they're training to fight the freshman team when we were gone. And that's exactly what we're seeing in Iraq and Syria, and as well as Syria today. And it's what we're currently seeing actually in Afghanistan today. The Taliban is retaking controls of small areas right now, but they're overrunning districts in not just one area of Afghanistan, but they've done it up in the north, they've done it in central Afghanistan, they've done it in the south, they've done it in the east. They're showing the Afghan people that they're committed to the fight and they're capable of doing it. They're, you know, in a perverse way, they're almost decade or maybe what, Iraq, 7 years of fighting us in Iraq and 12, 13 in Afghanistan, they're honing their TTPs, their tactics, techniques, and procedures to become better fighters, and we're seeing that on the battlefield these days. So that, you know, that to me is frightening, particularly when to me, it's just a matter of time until we see these suicide assaults happen in the I think it's possible to happen here in the United States. I have a theory on, I mean, if it was me, what I would do, and I'm not going to share it for your listeners because I don't like to give people ideas on how to conduct terrorist attacks against the United States. But when I game it out, it's extremely frightening.
Yeah, there's a lot of, you know, the old joke used to go, you know, sitting around a table with a bunch of people and say, well, I'm glad that we're not on their team because you can red cell some very interesting things. And, yeah, I share the hesitancy you want to talk about some things, but then you don't want to talk about something and then 18 months later it happens and you go, they didn't get that from me, did they? Logic is logic.
Look, I don't think they would, but it doesn't matter. I wouldn't sleep well regardless. Because the reality is I've seen it. I've seen it in action in different places. I mean, the way I would execute it here isn't necessarily the way I would do it in Mumbai or in Afghanistan, but I think there's a far more effective ways for them to do it, to strike fear in the American population and stop people from sending their kids to schools or be hesitant about going to the market or the post office or whatnot. But again, I'm not gonna go any further than that and actually give someone an idea.
When you look at the Long War and the lack of a better, our side is the West, the modern society. You know, some of the things that define what the West is or what a modern society is, it all depends on who you talk to. But some of the cornerstones is toleration of minorities, women's rights, and a relatively responsive and representative government accountable to the people. Imperfect as it is, in that area, one of the few places you can actually find that is in Kurdistan, especially the Iraqi portion of Kurdistan. And a lot of the ideas that we've talked about here, you know, after the second or third follow-on question, they become bad ideas, kind of like we talked about a little bit ago. But what is the downside, besides making Turkey itchy because of their significant Kurdish minority? What is the downside if we're going to accept the reality of the Islamic State at some point of being allowed the Kurds to have self-determination and to at last officially have their own nation and to find their own future on their own?
Well, I think at that point it may be a fait accompli. I mean, it's the downside of that, though, is how do the Turks respond? How does the Iranians respond? And how does the Iraqi government respond? So, you know, anything that it becomes a divisive issue. However, it just may become the reality of the situation. I mean, and look, we shouldn't fool ourselves. The Kurds, everybody's held the Peshmerga up for the last decade as being the toughest force, and then the Islamic State was started rolling over them. And I think the answer to that, why does this happen? Why did, and everyone was, well, they didn't have enough weapons, they didn't have enough ammunition. Look, that country is awash in weapons and ammunition. You can't tell me the Kurds don't have enough weapons and ammunition. They just didn't have the skill, and they didn't have the backbone to take on the Islamic State until the U.S. provided air support for them. Oh, and by the way, another terrorist group called the PKK, the Kurdistan Workers Party, which is a specially designated global terrorist group, its Syrian branch, so that gives it plausible deniability. It's called the YPG, I forget what it's like, the Syrian Kurdish Workers, I forget what the group is called. They were the ones that crossed the border and had to provide the backbone for the Kurds to take on the fight, not the Peshmerga. They were pretty much a beaten force, and that's why the U.S. got involved and launched airstrikes. So, you know, a question would be, if there is truly an Islamic State, you know, are the Kurds capable of holding it without assistance from the United States or Turkey? And then again, how does Turkey respond to this? Do they worry about portions of southern Turkey being carved out for part of a greater Kurdish state? Do the Iranians start worrying about the same thing? It's irrelevant for the Syrian government, which also has its own quote-unquote Kurd problem because the government's lost complete control of those areas already.
Well, we got about 4 minutes left. Let's solve this problem. I mean, I feel like it's almost like alcoholism. The first thing you got to do is admit you have a problem. And I'm not sure, is our government there? I mean, hearing these, yeah, okay.
Look, 13 years after 9/11, we still can't define the nature of the threat. We can't say what is a global jihadist group. We can't say what defines al-Qaeda. There's all these efforts to separate all these groups and make them distinct from each other, even though they don't operate that way or consider themselves that way. Bin Laden said himself in his own documents, he's of Abbottabad, and people completely misread this. He says, you know, the West refers to them as, you know, our affiliates and us as Al-Qaeda Central, but these are our regions, you know, or theaters. That's how he referred. And that's what the Al-Qaeda in East Africa and Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb and Al-Qaeda in the Indian subcontinent, those are the theaters or the regions, Al-Qaeda's regions in the war. Until we recognize that and recognize that they have an virulent religious ideology that is either ignored or accepted by a large or a significant portion of the Muslim world, until we're willing to recognize that, no, we can't create a strategy to defeat them. Sorry, I didn't mean to hijack your question there, but...
No, that didn't hijack it. That answered the question.
Okay, good.
Yeah, I keep coming back to a point that we had earlier on, you know, defining that term. You know, we've done this before. We have fought isms. We have fought philosophies. I think the problem is this is a religion, and that makes people uncomfortable because you're afraid somebody is going to call them a nasty name or something like that. But you know, you look at communist expansionism. You had the Soviet communism had similar goals and internationalist expansionist ideas, but there was not insignificant difference with the Chinese, the Vietnamese, the Cubans, and a lot of the other satellites. So this can be addressed, but I think unlike communism, it's easy for people to stop being a communist to becoming a free market person. When it's a religion, you run into a completely different psychological concept. I have a feeling we're going to have a few more episodes of Midrats on the long war because it's not really going anywhere. And kind of that lead in, Bill, what are some of the things that you and your team are working on now that we should keep an eye on? And if people are trying to set up their Google search engine, what some of the names or terms that people should keep an eye open for?
That's a good question. Sometimes I get so caught in the minutia of the day-to-day that it's hard to step back. But one of the things looking at continuing to try to identify jihadist groups' leadership, not just al-Qaeda, but the Islamic State's leaders, is there a possibility of rapprochement between the two groups? U.S. military operations inside of Iraq, We're working on plotting a map for what Boko Haram controls in northern Nigeria. It's a little difficult. A lot of these areas have either gone dark or have clearly been overrun in military operations by Boko Haram. Constantly watching this feud between Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State and seeing who sides where, and the answer to that question is all the core Al-Qaeda guys and all the affiliates have come down on the side of Al-Qaeda, and only you get these sort of marginal and splinter groups in other areas that have sided with the Islamic State. But the longer the state exists, again, the more it can, the more attractive it may become. And again, what is happening with the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan? What happens next? There's also something I've been tracking that's gotten zero play, is the schisms that have emerged between the Pakistani Taliban and how this could actually be a benefit to jihadist groups in northwestern Pakistan in the tribal areas, because I think they could actually turn out to, you know, even though there's a split in the organization, the new group that's formed has all of the very effective and dangerous leaders, and they could serve as a nucleus for the reorganization of the jihadists, which that movement of the Taliban and Pakistan movement kind of went a little stale when a couple of their top leaders were killed in drone strikes. So, we're constantly looking to see what the next thing is, and I got to tell you, I've never worked this hard. It is extremely difficult to track all of this at the same time, and we have a very small staff at the Long War Journal, and we're at the point where I wish I could double or triple the size, and we still wouldn't be able to cover everything.
Well, it's a great effort you've got going there. I really appreciate the work you guys put into it, and it's an excellent resource. I recommend it to everybody that wants to talk about the Long War, which they may know by another name, but in fact, it's what it is. Really appreciate you coming on again this time, Bill, and thanks for coming back so soon, but it seemed like events were moving so fast, we didn't want to wait 2.5 years to have you on again, and you've really helped a lot to enlighten a lot of us on what is and is not happening on the ground. So thank you very much.
The pleasure is all mine. Next time you need, call me as soon as you need me. I'm always happy to do the hour. It's the way radio should be done.
And appreciate everybody that joined us today for another mission of MIDRATS. And, hey, make sure and join us next week, where our guest will be Rear Admiral Tom Moore, PEO Aircraft Carriers. Until then, have a great Navy Day. Cheers.